welcome to the Econ Twitter water cooler. Glad to have you here. I don't think we need to do any introduction. Chris Miller, author of Chip War, I think probably one of the most talked about books over the last year. Chris, let's start with sort of bigger picture thoughts about semiconductors and who makes them and why. So, you know, economic theories of trade tend to focus on comparative advantage of countries, and then sort of secondarily to that, the policies that the governments there pursue. But throughout your book, it seems like firms and people are really consequential for major patterns in semiconductor production. So, like, if you think about, you know, why are we still making any DRAM at all in the United States? You have the story of Micron. You know, if potato billionaire Jack Simplot didn't think it was a good idea, what would our exports of DRAM look like today? And if you look at Morris Chang, had he been appointed CEO of Texas Instruments, you could imagine a totally different trajectory of Taiwanese semiconductor production and U.S. semiconductor production. So, like, my question is the way the story feels, is that just the nature of writing a history book that you tend to center on people or firm, or can we take out of your book some evidence for this sort of great man theory, or in this case, the great firm theory applied to semiconductors?
Well, I like the phrase great firm theory, and I think you do see some of that. You know, I think every individual and every firm is operating in a political economic context, and so you can't separate the question of which firms succeed from the question of the policy mix in which they're operating. But I do think the chip industry and its history has to be understood partly through the great firm theory, in part because of the concentration. And if you've got an industry where there are huge economies of scale and unique technologies that are difficult to replicate, that means the number of firms you have, the cutting edge, is small, which increases the likelihood that seemingly random decisions end up shaping the industry. And so I think, in contrast to an industry that's much more distributed, where you've got lots of potential players, the economies of scale in the chip industry do make it such that individual choices or the success or failure of an individual firm really does dramatically shape where the industry is focused.
Well, it's interesting because the economies of scale are not entirely new, but think of, as I guess, maybe the back two-thirds of the semiconductor industry. But if you rewind the clock, you still see a lot of focus on, not just in your book, obviously, but like in a lot of the telling of the history, you see a lot of focus put on where Shockley decided to locate his company in Palo Alto, and his mother being from the area. And you see a lot of focus on, you know, Fairchild and Moore. And, you know, those, it just feels like great firm, great industry type stories. But this is at a time when, you know, those were the upstarts. They weren't operating at economies of scale. They were still operating at relatively small levels of scales. I guess is the argument that they became scale economies, and so you can trace that back to the importance of small people, or is it that you can still have the importance of individuals when you're in a really entrepreneurial sort of upstart, unconcentrated environment as well?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's scale economies within that are experienced by an individual firm, and then there are scale economies of ecosystems. And, you know, I would argue, if you look at Silicon Valley from the earliest days when Shockley was setting up shop there, you know, it was partly due to his mother's location there. And so that's the historical contingency. It was also the case that if you were thinking of a place to start a high-tech startup at the time, actually the Bay Area made a lot of sense, from the radio industry in the area to the aviation industry. And so in terms of the number of firms working at the cutting edge in technologies that might be capable of becoming customers of your firm or supplying you with potential workers if you hired from other firms, there were some reasons that made the Bay Area attractive as well. So I guess in an answer that would, I guess, be sort of a classic answer from a historian, there's a mix of structure and agency that explains why you have certain ecosystems proving much more fertile than others. And one of the interesting questions that's been asked in studies of why Silicon Valley is why not Boston, where Route 128 was in the 1950s, 60s, even into the 70s, a center of computer production by most metrics was just as important a focal point for high-tech firms at the time, and then long out in comparison to Silicon Valley. And I think that is partly a story of the structure of the ecosystems being different, but it also can't be separated from the fact there were a number of just really successful firms that happened to be based in Silicon Valley, and the firms that were based in Boston were just less successful and attracted less critical mass around them.
Just to follow up on this, how has this kind of specialization changed over time? Because I can totally understand how in the early days of Silicon Valley, there was so much unique knowledge and tacit knowledge that was important in figuring out how to, you know, make semiconductors. But one thing I was kind of trying to figure out in your book and was still a little confused about is like, what exactly is TSMC's unique special sauce, right? So if you can now purchase, you know, EUV lithography machines from ASML, if anyone can buy these machines, what is it that, you know, the top end semiconductor manufacturers are literally doing that's just so difficult to replicate?
Yeah. You know, I think if it were easy to put your finger on the answer to that question, it would be easier to replicate what TSMC's special sauce is. I think there are a couple of things that you'd point to. It's true that anyone with a lot of money can buy the requisite machinery and the materials. And so it's clear that there are steps in TSMC's production processes that make them a more efficient user of these machines than anyone else, more efficient than Samsung, more efficient than Intel. But then the question to ask is, well, why are they not just the more efficient user this year, but why have they been more efficient for the past several years? And why do most people think they'll be better users of future generations of tools? Because the way the chip industry works, you have to bring online a new manufacturing process every year or so. And TSMC has been leading that for the last several years and is expected to lead that. And so it's also their R&D processes are either more efficient or more capable of being transitioned from R&D into high volume manufacturing. So it's both a question of learning to use the machines, but also turning that into mass manufacturing. And that's an organizational structure, an answer that has to be found in an organizational structure. You know, there's no one at TSMC who on their own knows the complete recipe for making an advanced semiconductor because it's too complex. There's too many process steps. No one can fit it in their mind. So there's something about the organizational structure of TSMC that has made it so capable, not just of being the best at this year's process, but repeatedly being the best at processes that actually change quite dramatically between different years. And I'm sure there's a fascinating Harvard Business School case study to be done on what makes TSMC work. But if anyone were to find the secret sauce in their organizational structure, TSMC, I'm sure, would be very hesitant to share it, because it's actually that rather than anything in their science or engineering that explains why they've had such an unparalleled track record in execution.
How important is culture there? And it's interesting because if we look at both, you know, the question we were talking about before about the origins of the computer industry in San Francisco, or if we talk about, you know, what is TSMC's special sauce, or on the negative side, if we look at why did Intel stumble, what was Andy Grove doing that they didn't keep doing? And also, you know, TSMC, when they stumbled and Morris Chang had to come back, it really does seem like beyond the actual, you know, structure of the firm itself, culture plays an essential role in both place, so the sort of environment, and also at the companies. Would you agree that's kind of a thieving through your book, the centrality of culture, or is that just part of the storytelling?
No, I think that is a theme, and it was a theme that to be honest, I found in some ways quite frustrating, because culture is a very hard thing to really get your head around. It's a hard thing to really describe what differentiates culture of one institution from a different institution. And I think there's a risk that we see a firm that works well, we deduce that it has a good culture. And that's actually the wrong causal relationship we'd like to be identifying. Firms that have certain cultures end up doing well. I think you can certainly look at cultures that focus on efficiency at high volume manufacturing as being absolutely critical. You can look at cultures that focus on precision and identifying errors and solving them as rapidly as possible is crucial in this industry. But in the end, I ended up concluding that culture was very important, but also that I really understand at the outset how I could identify whether a firm had a good culture or a bad culture, and felt like it ended up being a little bit of a black box to me as to why it was that certain firms had cultures that ended up producing very good results.
I can understand, though, if you're thinking about this, especially from a policy perspective, why the centrality of culture is frustrating. Because, you know, if you don't have the companies that have the culture that are there at the time, historically speaking, where you don't have the place that has the culture, you know, that can be a major impediment to success in any sort of industrial policy. It's a blocker. Right? It definitely feels in need of more exploration. And I tend to agree with you about the great man, great firm theory being overplayed in terms of the history of Silicon Valley, but their story is just as important there. Chris LeCoyer tells this story very well in his book when it comes to Silicon Valley. It's not just that there were already all these engineers there because of you know, microwave electronics and radio before that, but the sort of the cultural environment around them where you had all these tinkerers, these people who were hobbyists, you know, all the way up through the Homebrew Computer Club, that becomes a really important part of the story, the hobbyist tinkerer culture. And that is really difficult when you're trying to understand and explain how to generate agglomeration, how to create hubs, is that, you know, these cultures, really important background background factor. You know, economic historians like Joel Moiker struggle with this as well. They try to tell this story about how the centrality of scientific culture and craftsman culture is a driver of the Industrial Revolution. But it really is frustrating. You try to dig in for the deeper fundamental factors and you run into this sort of this thing called culture, which either at the firm or the place levels is really not, doesn't leave you with much good advice, does it?
Well, and I also felt like in the history of Silicon Valley, there were multiple competing definitions of what the culture was that made Silicon Valley unique. You got, on the one hand, the sort of tinkering mentality that you described. You've also got a part of the literature that emphasizes the countercultural aspects of Silicon Valley. And certainly in the interviews that I did and the work I did in the chip industry, there were a lot of people who wanted to escape the East Coast ethos and move to the West Coast. That was something that felt like a real driving force to a lot of people in the chip industry. And they defined what that meant in different ways, but there was a perception that the culture was different from a more constrained or constricted environment in the East Coast. And you get that in the stories of people like Steve Jobs as well. But these are two definitions of culture that are totally different.
It's so true. I actually think that, you know, there's different cultures for different times in the firm or the industry history. So like if you look at Homebrew Computer Club, it's so crucial for a lot of important breakthroughs in early computing. And there are obviously a lot of important people like Wozniak involved in that. And you know, that was a sort of atmosphere that helped create all the engineers who were ready to jump on to personal. But a lot of what Steve Jobs did was just a huge rejection of the Homebrew Computer Club mentality. And it's like, all right, the time for tinkers is over. And if it had been left in the hands of, you know, those kinds of people, they were building for themselves. They weren't building for the users. So it you're right. It makes the challenge even harder. But it's not just, you can't just say this is the culture of agglomeration and we need that. It's sort of like you need a mix of it, or historically at least, you can look back and say there are a mix of different kinds of cultures contributing importantly here, and they all matter, but it's not clear when one will matter or when one will get it right and one will get it wrong.
And I was also struck by the, you know, on the one hand, the tinkering and the startup ethos, obviously critical. You can't tell the history without that. But in the chip industry, you need to build vast firms that sell millions of products to be remotely successful. And so there's a really interesting dynamic between, on the one hand, the individual working in their garage, which is part of the myth, but also part of the reality of Silicon Valley. But then from going from that position to mass manufacturing, which is critical, is a very different culture. And yet Silicon Valley has been able to do both of them in a somewhat puzzling way, to be honest.
Yeah, like if you were to ask the question, like, what did Steve Wozniak and Charlie Spork have in common? Not a lot, right? Not a lot. Yet they both reflected something that was, you know, basically necessary for the success of Silicon Valley. Let's talk a little bit about globalization. So in your book, you seem to lay a lot of the blame for the geopolitical problems in semiconductors that we have today or the risks squarely on the globalization ideology. I'll read a quote here. American tech policy was held hostage to banalities about globalization that were easily seen to be false. America's technological fabrication, lithography, and other fields had dissipated because Washington convinced itself that companies should compete, but the government should simply provide a level playing field. Let me push back on this a little bit. I think you'd agree that if we look at what are the geopolitical problems we're dealing with, there are two main ones. One is that some parts of the supply chain are highly concentrated, and two, parts of the supply chain that are sensitive for national security aren't really in the U.S. anymore. But if we look at the first problem of concentration, as you've already suggested, a lot of this is just the economics of the industry, the necessity of scale. Don't those economies of scale mean that the concentration problem was going to be a problem sort of regardless of the actions of the U.S. government? Can that really be laid at the feet of globalization?
Well, I think in some ways it's unfair to blame globalization because it begs the question of, you know, who is that? Who are you pointing the blame actually at? I think if you'd ask any policymaker, any business leader, any customer of chips 10 years ago, would you like to be in a situation in 10 years' time where almost all of the world's most advanced processors can only be produced in Taiwan? Everyone would have said no. And certainly, would there have been costs in changing the trajectory? Answer, that's obviously yes. But would the costs have been lower to change the trajectory 10 years ago than they are now in terms of trying to shift an industry that's already been built up? You know, it's clear that that would be the case. And so I think criticizing globalization is a very broad thing to criticize, but it seems to me that we were collectively not thinking enough about trend lines in the industry, about the likelihood that relations with China would sour, implications of that for the goods and technologies that we required. That's not to say that there weren't good reasons for the industry's structure becoming the way it's structured today, but I think even recognizing those good reasons, recognizing the economies of scale, recognizing the path dependencies, I think all of us would have said we wish we'd made some different decisions 10 years ago that would put the industry in a different place today.
Can I ask you about the term friend zoning here, right? So I don't think that's something that you discuss explicitly in the book, but I kind of read a theme here because you kind of talk about how companies like Fairchild have gone to Hong Kong. And so clearly going international has been a key part of the semiconductor industry beginning. Kind of talk about Andy Grove's vision of doing it all in the US, and you say, well, that's not really consistent either. So it seems like, you know, to Adam's point, there is just globalism inherent in the industry. It's really this second point he brought up of having parts of that supply chain being entangled with competitors of the US geopolitically. So it seems like this kind of friend, you know, kind of idea of kind of keeping supply chains with friendly countries as a way of kind of striking a balance between those two positions. And I kind of read in the book some sort of sympathy for that approach, but I figured I'd just ask you directly what you think of that idea.
Yeah, I think that's right. First off, on the wording of what we're talking about, you know, I think it's wrong to say that globalization is inevitable in the industry because we don't have a globalized industry. We have a globalized consumer base of chips, but a super highly concentrated production base. There's only five countries that really matter in making chips. And so it's very much not globalized in terms of produces chips. And I think that's important to note because a lot of the banalities that we hear thrown around about globalization don't actually look at how goods are produced. And semiconductors are perhaps somewhat unique in the level of concentration, but actually many types of goods have globalized consumption, but not global production. And I think that's important because insofar as we've made errors in the way the trade system is structured today, or the way supply chains are structured today, is that we've sort of assumed that we don't have to look very hard at how supply chains are structured or where production is taking place. And I think that is an error. And I guess the one thing that I learned the most from researching this book is that there's a ton of interesting things to be learned, some optimistic, some frightening, about actually digging into supply chains and how they're structured. So that's on the framing of what's actually global and what's not global. I think it is true to say, though, that the industry has benefited tremendously from being international, both in the sense that there's a large worldwide consumer market you can sell to, and from the fact that if you've got companies that are able to acquire the most advanced materials and components from the US and Europe and Japan and Korea, et cetera, then they can make goods more efficiently. And so that has also been, you ask about friendshoring. I don't know that I love the love the word, but I think the concept is right, that we need to think a little bit more than we have about, are we relying on adversaries in a way that makes us more vulnerable? And then when it comes to semiconductors, I think the answer is very clearly yes.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, as you have the point, you can point to one part of the supply chain process as being, you know, highly concentrated in a handful of countries, obviously EUV being the most extreme example. But, you know, the globalized nature of the supply chain is really not just about, you know, where ASML is located, but not only where does ASML get its parts and its equipment from, but could they have even done without globalization? And I think that that's sort of a story that is obviously told in your book, but I think that it sort of leans against the idea that we've globalized too much or that globalization has failed to live up to its promises. Like, behind the clock, it was not clear at all that EUV could be done. And I think you explained in very useful detail how difficult it was and how ASML had to rely on the best firm at what they were doing. And if you tried to do that within any, for example, like China's going to be forced to do now, it most likely couldn't be done. So I think that there's a simple fact that's kind of missing from the discussion, which is that without globalizing the supply chain, Moore's Law probably would have stopped a while ago. Would you agree with that?
But again, I think that's where the word global is misleading. I think it's not true to say without globalizing the supply chain, Moore's Law would have stopped. I think if you were to phrase it differently, to say without taking advantage of advanced industries in the US, Europe, and Japan, Moore's Law would have stopped, I think that's correct. And there's a vast difference between global and G7 economies. And that's where the politics comes back in, because when economists discuss trade, they like to pretend that it doesn't matter which countries you're producing in. But of course, it matters tremendously. And that's why I think we need to push back hard against when people throw around the word global when in fact they mean international, or when they use global when in fact they're referring to a small number of countries, because actually these distinctions matter fundamentally. And I think it's highly difficult to imagine that EUV is produced using components basically from the US, Europe, and Japan. So that's not global. That's G7.
Well, that's focusing on the most like advanced portion of the supply chain, but that's, you know, so the advanced portions are going to be globalized within the more advanced countries, but the other parts of the supply chain that do rely on low-cost manufacturing, and especially if we rewind the clock and we look back to the earliest days of Moore's Law, where, you know, Fairchild and Noyce were thinking, okay, how do we get costs down? Because when costs drop, use goes up. And that was like the whole game, right? Like, how do we get costs down? And globalization, in the sense of low-income, low-skilled countries playing an important role, in terms of assembly was a huge part of why Moore's law was able to continue at that point. You don't see low skilled countries or more developing countries in the assembly kinds of things where the U.S. really is not going to be competitive. You don't see that as an important component of the continuation of advancement.
No, I think that's critical. But I think our conversation, we've just used globalization to refer both to extensive trade between advanced economies and to a in my view, completely different economic and political phenomenon, which is offshoring low value manufacturing assembly to low wage countries. And those have both been very economically positive. I'm supportive of both, but I think they're very different. And I think our ability to analyze trade and supply chains has been really hampered by the fact that we've just thrown lots of different really separate economic phenomenon under the phrase globalization and not dug into, well, what are the implications of these different types of trade and investment flows? And the implications are quite different. And if we'd started not with the rubric of anything that crosses a border is, quote, globalization, but in fact, we need to actually carefully differentiate how do we understand this flow or that flow, we'd have ended up with, I think, a much richer understanding of how does the global economy get pieced together and what are the implications of that in political and economic terms.
I certainly agree that we it's important to distinguish between North-North flows and what thought of as North-South flows. Why they matter? I think we both agree that they're crucial to the industry, crucial to the continuation of Moore's law, but certainly different phenomenon. Let's talk about ASML, because I think this is one of the most important and interesting parts of the book. And it's also the most concentrated part of the supply chain. So there are a lot of points in the book where it feels like you are saying that we made mistakes, both policymakers, companies. I guess that's mostly it. Policymakers and firms themselves made mistakes. But sometimes I feel myself wanting to ask, well, explore the counterfactual here a bit more and give us the counterfactual. So I want to talk about a few different counterfactuals that were sort of went into a little bit in the book without really fully taking a stance on what should have been done. So let's talk about when ASML bought SEG, Silicon Valley Group. This was at the time the last largest remaining U.S. lithography company. And you have these two countervailing perspectives. You have the national security folks, a handful of them worrying about the U.S. losing the last EUV maker or the last lithography company. And on the other hand, you have Intel and other folks saying, like, this is a necessary step towards making EUV work. Do you think we would be in a better place today if the U.S. government had blocked ASML's purchase of SFG? Is that one of the counterfactuals we should have rewinded on?
So I think that's an interesting counterfactual to think through. I think the answer is ultimately no, we'd not be in a better place had that happened. And I think if by that point, I think what's critical to note is that the U.S. already had a bad choice between losing direct control over this critical technology that had been partially invented in the United States with really important economic and security applications. You could block that, or you could let it go through, and either way, the options were in some ways negative. You'd evolve it, or you'd slow innovation. That was absolutely critical. And so you've got to rewind the clock further behind that deal and to ask, well, why was it that an industry that was invented in the U.S. just three or four decades before this transaction, why was it that by that point the U.S. had already lost leadership in the industry? And there you get to some actors that are partly idiosyncratic, but probably not entirely idiosyncratic. And so I tell the story in the book of GCA, yeah, which was a company based outside of Boston that that was a defense contractor at first, made devices for the Air Force and intelligence and space uses, and eventually diversified into lithography for commercial uses. And they were a star firm in the early 1980s, but then were mismanaged in interesting ways and couldn't get their business model to work in the end of the 80s and lost market share to competitors in Japan and lesser extent in the Netherlands. And so partly the decline of GCA is a story of a management team that screwed up. And there's all sorts of fun anecdotes of the ways that they overspent in the good years and were unprepared for the bad years. But I think there's also structural factors that are at play. GCA declined at the same time as the rest of the Boston-based tech ecosystem declined in the 1980s, which suggests to me that it wasn't entirely about this one firm. It was about an overall tech ecosystem becoming less important. It also declined at a time when U.S. manufacturing in general was struggling in the face of competition from a number of different countries, but especially from Japan. And so in some ways, I think you can't not interpret the decline of GCA in the context of this broader rise in Japanese competition across the U.S. manufacturing sector. And that has a whole variety of causes. We can talk about cultures, again, of manufacturing. We can talk about the Japanese exchange rate. We can talk about lots of issues. And so I guess I end up in the lithography question thinking that by the transaction we started this conversation with, it was already too late to have an optimal outcome. We were already in the realm of suboptimal outcomes. And if you wanted to fully rewind to a place where we could have reached some more optimal outcomes of having a technology that was advancing very rapidly, fully in control of the United States, you'd have to go back and not only fix this one firm, which is probably fixable on its own, but maybe not. And maybe you'd also have to address, well, what was it that ailed U.S. manufacturing more generally, or the Boston tech ecosystem more generally in the 1980s? And that's obviously a very hard counterfactual to get your head around.
It really is. It's hard, especially in terms of thinking about GCA, because I mean, in a lot of ways, what it seems like you are arguing we should have been doing or should be doing in the book kind of was done, right? Like SemaTech was the industry and the government coming together, trying to save lithography, trying to do what they could, giving, you know, tens of millions of dollars to GCA, spending, you know, the government spent $500 million on this. Was SemaTech too late, or was it too little? Because how do you see that period of history?
It's a great question, a critical question. I think my understanding of what went wrong at GCA was not that the technology was bad. In some ways, a lot of people I spoke to deep in the lithography industry thought that they actually had the best technology, but that their mass manufacturing and their quality in producing replicas of their most advanced system fell behind Japanese and Dutch rivals. And as a result of that, they entered the mid-90s, a period in which the chip market entered a downturn in a really weak financial position, and then didn't have the money to invest. And anyway, their customers didn't trust them because they had a track record of producing high-tech but low-quality systems that had too many faults in them. And so it's if you ask, what's the factor that could turn things around? Certainly the company ran out of money, but it's not obvious that an additional $10 or $20 million or however many million dollars was really what they needed, because they built up a reputation in the middle of the 1980s of having impressive machines, but not having the reputation for precision manufacturing that competitors did. And so I actually ended up thinking that government intervention maybe could have helped, but it wasn't actually getting at the key problem, nor did it seem plausible that a government official coming from the outside would have really identified the problem or known what to do about it. And if you ask, well, why was it that Nikon in Japan, for example, which was had a long history in lenses, which is kind of the key technology undergirding lithography, but they hadn't built lithography systems until a decade after GCA started. Why was it that Nikon was able to scale up in a way that won customers trust more than GCA? You get back to these very murky questions of culture. Why was it that if GCA's technology was great, they couldn't mass manufacture the machines at the right level of quality? No one I talked to was really able to give me an answer to that question. It was just that GCA, the company, didn't work well, and its competitors did.
It's very tough. It's very tricky, I think, because it seems like you almost need to rewind the clock before. By the time SemaTech comes along, it's too late, right? GCA has ruined the reputation. But if you rewind the clock to when it would have been soon enough, core problems with GCA were cultural. So I look at this, and I sort of feel this inner conflict from you, Chris, in your book. That I feel this struggle that you see history as having been played out, maybe biased by too much optimism, and it feels like mistakes were made. But when we dig into all these tough decisions, it seemed like turning points. It does seem like it's hard to devise an actual counterfactual where we did better. And so it starts to feel like, you know, there's this sort of frustration with policymaking companies at the time, but like was it not inevitable, at least up till 2010 or something? Like, was there not some sort of inevitability to a lot of what we've seen?
I think you're right to identify the tension. And I tried to take very seriously both the business people that I interviewed who ended up making mistakes and understand the, you know, they face horrific uncertainty as they look into the future, trying to make decisions, and government officials the same way. They're trying to understand business environments that are difficult for them to understand, and put that next to political constraints and policy constraints. And so I agree that there aren't a large number of people who I can put a finger on and say, this person screwed up and I know exactly what I would have done differently. There are some instances of that, but in a lot of instances, I think you're right that it's hard to, with confidence. And I think we need to be humble looking back at history with confidence and say, here's what ought to have been done differently. I think when you get to the post-2010 period, it is different. I was struck, though, by a couple of things. I think, first off, the U.S. has, I think, underperformed what you might expect in terms of its precision, high-volume measuring capabilities. And there are companies like Intel in its glory days that are exceptions to this rule. But it does seem to me that repeatedly over the last several decades, when U.S. firms have fallen behind, it's not been because their technology is bad. It's it's always often been great. It's because they've struggled to turn that into a mass manufactured product at high volume. And that was true. That was the problem GCA had. That's the problem that U.S. chip makers are facing. And so I do put my finger on that as an issue. Now, is that an issue you'd resolve by policy or by culture? I guess that's an interesting debate we could have. And then I think the second issue that I think is structural in the way we think about the world is that we have been for over a generation insufficiently critical-minded when we look at international trade, which isn't to say that I think it's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. But I think we've not actually interrogated the structures at play and articulated, well, what are we comfortable with? What is benefiting us? And are there certain types of trade that we have wrongly lumped into the generic trade category that actually has not made us better off?
Just to follow up on that, what are your views on sort of the CHIPS Act, right? That's obviously trying to reshore chip activity back to the United States. And there are a lot of questions, I think, about whether it's a narrowly targeted industrial policy that's going to be successful at that. You know, Adam has, of course, voiced his concerns about whether there's too many conflicting motives in that. But I'm just curious about your view. Do you think that kind of the policy initiatives that we're taking are generally in the right direction because they're moving away from the globalist view? Are they still too disparate in trying to achieve too many objectives at once to be really effective at this? How do you kind of view the policy landscape?
So I started from the conclusion of my research very very skeptical and hesitant about efforts to intervene in an industry that is so complex, a supply chain that government officials will just inevitably struggle to understand, given the complexity and the information asymmetries. And that's not to knock them, that's just the reality. But I also wake up every morning thinking about just how horrific it would be if there was a blockade of Taiwan and how I think catastrophically unprepared we are. And so it does seem to me that if you look at the likely cost of that outcome and multiply it by whatever probability you assign to it, you end up with an expected value that is well above the amount of funds we're spending on the CHIPS Act. And that alone, the thesis that we're buying a pretty expensive insurance policy, but actually not that expensive to the downside risk, I think is plenty of justification for the funds Congress put forth.
Can I follow up on that as well, actually? So you kind of talked about, okay, clearly the geopolitical risk here is something about something happening to Taiwan, right? Whether it's an invasion or a blockade. And even recently, I think Chinese ships are starting to kind of stop ships coming into Taiwan. So it's, I think very clear to see how that kind of scenario might play out in ways that are very bad for the United States. I guess the thing that I was left wondering about from the book is you kind of stress this geopolitical conflict with chips, Russia, right? And how chips were so instrumental in the United States. It's really demonstrate this technological capacity that really lapped Russia by the end of the Cold War. And what I'm basically wondering is, what's the role for chips in future warfare, and how central are Taiwanese made frontier chips specifically in that? Because it at least still seems to me that a lot of the chips used for conflict these days are not at that frontier level. And so while a blockade of Taiwan would be devastating for the U.S. consumer industry, how much would it impact, I don't know, military capacity broadly, which might be reliant on less advanced chips? Alternatively, maybe your view is that, well, the frontier chips are actually totally necessary for certain applications like AI, and that's really the future, including even the future of warfare. And so that's why it's so central to try to keep either Taiwan well ensconced within the friend set of countries, or figure out ways of replicating that capacity elsewhere.
Yeah. So when it comes to military and intelligence uses, it's certainly the case that, like all complex manufactured goods, there are a lot more low-end chips than high-end chips in military systems, and that's true of cars, dishwashers, and almost all types of devices, true of smartphones too. So quantitatively, the military needs lots of low-end chips. And the military actually has unique demands for low-end chips because it keeps devices in service for decades. In contrast to all of your electronics devices in your house, which you keep around for a couple of years and then throw out, the military is still operating 30-year-old airplanes and things like that. So they got unique demands for old chips. But as you say, when the Defense Department or defense ministries around the world are thinking about future capabilities, and as no less important, intelligence agencies are thinking about future capabilities, they're thinking as much about what the data center looks like that trains the algorithms that will help these devices operate as they're thinking about the devices themselves. And I think we're at an inflection point in terms of the economy and in terms of productivity growth. In the past, we thought primarily about economic output coming from factories and productivity growth coming from those factories producing more stuff more efficiently. And I think that's still going to be relevant, but I think the factories of the future are the data centers that are hammering out more efficient algorithms on their GPUs. And that is just true for military systems as it is for civilian applications. And so the types of chips that are actually training AI systems are largely made in Taiwan. And so ensuring a steady supply of access to those is you know, I think absolutely critical for not only for our ability to produce stuff, but also our ability to train that stuff to be smarter.
I've got a lot of questions about chips, but before we continue jumping in there, I do want to ask one more question about the history counterfactuals. Because I do sort of contradict myself a little bit. I do sort of see one decision, I think, where we reran, it was a mistake in hindsight, and if we reran history, we might be in a better place. But ironically, it was a mistake of not being too deferential to globalization or uncritical of it, but being too skeptical of globalization. And I would say, curious to get your thoughts on this, the U.S. lacked any potential companies that could have competed with ASML for EUV technology, but Japan had Nikon and Canon. And the reason that we didn't give access to it was because we were afraid of trade with them. The quote from your book was, the U.S. government, still sensitive from the trade wars of the 1980s, didn't want Japan's Nikon and Canon to work with the national labs. If we could rerun history and be a little more pro-globalization at that moment, did that fear of Japan, which I feel like seems really a little silly in retrospect. I mean, would we be potentially in a better spot today with multiple less concentration around now?
So I think that's an interesting fashion, but I think, you know, you're using the G word again. I don't think the G word exists. I think it refers to multiple separate processes. So if you're asking me, do I think the U.S. was wrong in the 1990s to remain highly sensitive to the trade disputes of the 1980s with regard to Japan? I think the answer is yes, but I don't think that my answer to that question has any bearing on some of the other processes that you might group under the phrase globalization.
Yeah, I guess
I don't believe that is a coherent concept. Like, I guess that's my core point, and I think the conclusion of the book is that there is no global economy. There are distinct supply chains that intersect countries in different ways, and you've got to look, you know, where the factories are located and where the trade flows go. And if you start taking apart globalization, you'll find that there is an electronic supply chain which functions totally differently from the textile supply chain, which functions totally differently from the petrochemical supply chain. And I think the answer of, are we happy with the structure of globalization, is unanswerable. But I think you can answer the question, are we happy with the structure of the textile supply chain or the electronic supply chain? That seems like a much more tangible thing that we can get our heads around.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a very broad term. I think we agree on that. But I do think that, you know, if we're talking about, you know, the book certainly takes the case that there was an idea about globalization, that there was this mindset of optimism and lack of criticism towards globalization. So, like, jumping off that framework in the book, I just think that's it's incomplete, because we have what is, I think, probably the clearest historical counterfactual where it was not, where that the opposite of that mindset sort of steered us in the wrong direction. I do think it matters today, because you still have this sort of lack of nuance when it comes to the critics of globalization, who think we've, you know, gone too far and we onshore more of everything. And I think we have the same message here, is that you got to be more nuanced than that. But I think it's important to have the historical record be correct, that, like, there are turns in history where fear of trade, fear of globalization, led to bad results, and have often, I think, clearer counterfactuals than the cases where lack of criticism about globalization did the opposite.
Yeah, I think fear of trade, I would agree with you that a lesson of the book is that we should not be afraid of trade per se. I think that's right. But I think it's another lesson of the book is that all trade flows are different. Yeah. They might appear as a dollar on a Excel spreadsheet that shows you the current account of the country or their balance of trade, but they're all different, and they all have different impacts.
That's fair. Let's talk about chips, then. Let's dig in there some more. What do you think are the... So let's start by talking about divide mature node from the more advanced production. What are the biggest risks to our odds success of, you know, onshoring or spurring significant production of advanced semiconductors in the U.S.?
So I think it's clear that if we subsidize production, we can get companies to open new facilities. You know, that's a straightforward process. And we're already seeing that happen. The question is, can you subsidize them in a way that will create path dependencies, that will lead them to invest round two without subsidies in a couple of years down the road? And that's where the uncertainty, I think, lies. And it's a very hard thing to get companies to do. The reason we have to subsidize is, A, because a lot of the critical companies we're looking to get to build facilities are not based in the U.S., don't have large operations here, have a inbuilt bias to invest in their home markets, but B, because it's more expensive in the U.S. And so if we want to create path dependencies that that induce more non-subsidized investment in the future, it will take, I think, very careful institutional design to produce those. And I think the Commerce Department has been right to talk about clusters and ecosystems as some of the institutions that that have a chance of creating those path dependencies that will lead to future non-subsidized investment. But I think, you know, I won't surprise anyone to say that it's far from guaranteed that we'll get the next round and the round after that of non-subsidized investment. And whether we do or not will be critical to the success.
I think you're right. Path dependence is the game. And that's sort of what I keep trying to focus people on is I see one of the biggest risks to path dependency is all the regulations. And obviously Morris Chang sees it the same way as well. The level of regulations and zoning problem, expenses, cost of building here. And my big criticism of the CHIPS Act and its implementation is it's done a lot of things that push us in the opposite direction. If we want to convince these companies that they shouldn't just build this fab that's highly subsidized here, but build their next fab, it's important to help them build these fabs at lower cost versus we'll lard it up with all these different asks, and then we'll just compensate them with a higher subsidy level. Do you see this in the CHIPS Act and its implementation, these cost raisers and a lack of focus on how do we actually make changes that reduce the costs here? Or are the costs so structurally built into the U.S. economy that there's nothing we can even really do about it? Is it ultimately about difference in per capita income or something?
So it's not actually largely about per capita income. If you look at the countries that are the lowest cost in terms of producing chips, it's Taiwan and Korea, which are upper middle income countries, not low income countries. And labor costs are part of the story, but a relatively small part. Permitting is a huge problem in the U.S. The U.S. is the major country where it takes the longest to build a chip-making facility, longer than in Europe, according to the studies that have been done. And that's the fault partly of the federal government, partly also of local and state governments. And so whether or not that changes will, I think, be very important to the success of these efforts. I think that next to the cost question, which I agree with you, it's critical, is the question of can companies be convinced that there are other benefits to producing in the U.S.? First, are there ways you can get better access to the R&D ecosystem in the U.S. by having production here? I think I'm not sure that the answer is yes, but it's plausible the answer is yes. And companies like TSMC have talked about that as a benefit of producing in the U.S., better access to a lot of the R&D. Second, most of the customers of companies like Samsung and TSMC are U.S. firms. And so is there a benefit from being closer to your customer geographically? I don't know that the answer is yes, but it seems plausible that the answer could be yes. And so that's another potential benefit that I think firms will be exploring. And so I think the U.S. government is hoping that it can make a difference on the cost front, and you know, with the caveats that you put out that more needs to be done there, but also to test the thesis that there might be some benefits that increase productivity, make it easier for these companies to understand what their customers want and sell more higher value chips as a result. Am I confident that those dynamics exist? No. Is it possible they do? It's certainly possible that they do. And I think insofar as we're investing more in R&D simultaneous to this effort, it does increase the likelihood that we do get these types of results.
Let's talk about mature node chips a bit more, because as your book makes clear, these are actually more important for immediate defense needs. And also, are, you know, where the, when we talk about the issue of supply chain resilience and what was demonstrated from the crisis, which it sort of has spurred this. I think you probably agree we wouldn't be having the conversation about chips if it wasn't for COVID. It wasn't for the shortages there, and that's where the shortages were. So, but I sort of see the economics here being very different. How do you think about this? Because, you know, if we want to produce a select number of very crucial chips, I understand we'll just throw money at that and then they'll be made here and we'll have secure access to them. But when we talk about issues like resiliency, I have a hard time understanding how this works, because say we take some mature node chip and say it's not important for missiles, we're doing it for resiliency purposes. We increase the global supply by increasing, you know, by causing someone to build a plant for it here. I see two problems with the assumption that this helps us if there's some other future shock. One, on an ongoing sense, you're not really going to spur the industry to operate with excess capacity, right? Capital is going to adjust. So a plant somewhere else is going to close. So the idea that businesses are just going to sit around with excess capacity for mature node chips, is that tenable? And second, you know, supposing we do make them here versus Canada or Mexico or one of our allies, like, how does that actually help us be more resilient unless the plan is to seize chips with the Defense Production Act? Like, I don't really understand the advantage of having them here versus literally any ally. How do you view those two issues?
So I don't think there is an advantage in resiliency terms to having chip production here versus in Canada or wherever. But when it comes to mature node, a vast share produced in Taiwan and actually a large share produced in China today. And so in the risk scenarios we're talking about, in addition to losing 90% of the most advanced processors made in Taiwan, you also lose a major chunk of low-end chips that end up in cars and dishwashers. And so I think it is, as part of the expensive insurance policy that we're buying, I think it's not, it's useful to have a bit more production in the U.S. as well as in Japan and in Europe and in Singapore and anywhere else. I think that's all good if you buy my insurance policy metaphor. I think the question of are we right to be focusing more on leading edge versus lagging edge has a couple of different potential responses. One is that the way the industry works is if you build a leading edge fab today, in 5 years or 10 years, that is the lagging edge fab. So if you're successful at setting up the types of clusters that the Commerce Department wants, over a 10-year time horizon, they will both get leading-edge fabs that will be built over time if you get this path dependency investment, plus the facilities that are 2 years old, 4 years old, et cetera, will become more lagging-edge fabs. And so you end up starting to snowballing in capacity that's the result of that, if the plan works. But I think it's not crazy to think that that's a reasonable thing to bet on. Because if it does work, then your problem really starts to not get completely solved, but you make some real progress on that. I think the second thing is that we know that there are multiple companies, including some in the U.S., that have no difficulty producing lagging edge chips. And so if there were a worst case scenario tomorrow, those companies would need to buy new tools, they need to hire new employees, it wouldn't be easy, but they could, using their existing knowledge, scale up production of lagging edge chips. Whereas leading edge, it's a much more complex situation. We wouldn't have the knowledge that we would need to begin to scale up that production. So in addition to requiring more complex tools, we'd also need to rebuild the knowledge, not from scratch, but from something that was closer to it. And so that's why I think it's not at all a bad strategy to focus on the leading edge in the U.S. And the final point is that if you look at what other countries are doing, Europe, Japan, India, Singapore, they're subsidizing lagging edge. And we're going to benefit from the resilience aspect of that because more capacity outside of China and the Taiwan Straits is capacity that is likely to stay online, the worst case scenario.
Do you think then that it's a mistake for the CHIPS Act to put subsidies into mature node production? I mean, they're spending billions of dollars on mature node production as well. Should we just be focusing on the advanced stuff and wait for the sort of trickle down?
I think it's not unreasonable to say we're going to have a somewhat diversified approach, not only betting on three leading edge firms in logic, but also spending a bit of money on lagging edge, just on the grounds that if we take a more diversified set of bets, some of them are more likely to pay off. So I think it's not unreasonable.
Let's talk a little bit about spies, shall we? You got spies in the book, a very interesting part of the book, the history of Soviet spies coming here, trying to steal our secrets, and how we sort of just allowed it to happen. There's obviously a much more current debate around this, and there's two sorts of stories that I hear. I'm curious where you land on this. One is that high-skilled immigration has always been central to U.S. semiconductor production, basically any advanced industry in the U.S. from Andy Grove to Gene Horney. You point to the importance of high-skilled immigrants in all of U.S. innovation history. So we need high-skilled immigrants, especially in bringing back some of the knowledge that we may have lost in production. So in this telling, we need to bring more high-skilled immigrants here. Not only that, but allowing more high-skilled immigrants from China weakens their ability to produce at the leading edge. We should be vacuuming up every engineering PhD, every computer science PhD we can from there. That'll help us accomplish the run fast. The other perspective is that that China, one of the ways that they help, that they're trying to catch up to us is through spies, and that it's a very difficult task. How do you identify spies? And so you hear claims that we should literally cut off immigration from China. Where do you land on this? If you to take 500,000 skilled Chinese immigrants and you bring them here, or you keep them in China, which is better for the technological gap?
Well, I would gladly take the immigrants. I think the track record of the industry is that many of the key individuals, and not to oversubscribe to the great entrepreneur theory of history, but in the history of the chip industry in the U.S., there have been many critical points in the industry has seen immigrants play a key role. I think second is that what we've found over the last several years is that the attractiveness of people who have studied and worked in the U.S. returning to tech jobs in China has declined. And so the risk of specialized knowledge filtering back, I think, is somewhat lower than what it would have been 10 years ago when it was very common to have engineers going back and forth. And then third, I think most interestingly, is the U.S. government has now used a really interesting and provocative set of policy tools to make it illegal for U.S. citizens or green card holders to work with a suite of different different Chinese chip firms. And when those controls were out last fall, there were a bunch of U.S. citizens, green card holders in leadership positions of Chinese chip firms. And according to the media accounts, many of them resigned because they preferred to keep their green cards or citizenship rather than work with Chinese chip firms. So I think, you know, that was a controversial move. We could probably debate the wisdom of that move. But I think anyone who's read about large-scale IP theft should look at that, look at the disincentives that's created. And it seems to me that the takeaway from that is that actually we've now got a pretty strong regulatory disincentive not to take specialized knowledge and go back and work with certain Chinese firms. So all that makes me a lot less worried about IP theft relative to the benefits that immigrants have historically brought.
Can I follow up on these sort of strategies to sort of deny China access to the highest quality chips? It seems like these efforts have found increased support across sort of the Western world. More and more countries and firms are willing to sign on to them. But I'm worried about sort of two things. One is the possibility that if China is unable to kind of access the best foreign chips, might that potentially just jumpstart China's own efforts to develop its own chip making capacity, eventually allowing it to kind of leapfrog and reach the frontier of chips, which then would be denied to the US and others. The possibility that Neil Ferguson has sort of raised is he's made the parallel to Japan, where Western efforts to, American efforts to sort of embargo Japan on the basis of oil sort of potentially led to the war by convincing Japan that there was no future absent armed conflict. It sort of worries that these kinds of efforts to try to deny Chinese chip making capacity, would they potentially actually encourage China to engage in riskier activities with respect to Taiwan out of the fear that they may get permanently leapfrogged?
Yeah. And we should probably wrap up in a minute. We're past the hour. But I think, you know, first off, will China try harder to catch up? I think it's going to try hard to catch up. But actually, the last decade, I've seen a lot of government efforts to catch up. The government has spent, it's hard to know the exact number, but tens of billions of dollars a year trying to catch up. Industrial policy programs like Made in China 2025, the National Integrated Circuit Fund, a whole different array of provincial funds have been pouring money into the chip industry. And so people who say, well, now China's going to try really hard to catch up are suggesting that, well, now it's going to spend even more money and capital constraints. The assumption has to be we're the problem faced by the Chinese chip industry. You know, I just don't know how plausible that actually sounds. It seems to me that if you think China's going to try harder to catch up now, you've actually got to assume not that they're going to spend more money. Maybe they will, but that's not the problem, but that they're going to become better venture capitalists as a result. And I guess I just don't know the justification for the thesis that that this is going to improve the hit rate of Chinese government venture investments. It just doesn't seem that plausible to me. I think on the point that Neil makes, I think, you know, the oil embargo in Japan was not a targeted embargo. Had it been pursued over a longer period of time, it would become impossible to drive a car in Japan. You know, the macroeconomic effects were felt on day one. By contrast, this year, last year, next year, the macroeconomic impacts of the chip controls would be imperceptible. You won't see an impact on headline GDP figures. You won't see an impact outside of the chip industry and the data center industry. And so I think the controls have in some ways been carefully sculpted such that if you're in the AI industry or the high performance computing industry, you're going to feel the impact of these controls. But if you're not, then unless you read the newspaper carefully, you probably haven't. And so that, I think, makes me conclude that the 1941 analogy is really a very different type of situation.
That's a great point. So chips aren't the new oil in this case, exactly, thankfully. Well, we can go ahead and wrap it up there. So we are past the hour. Chris, really appreciate you taking time to come and chat. Really great conversation.
This was fun. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Take care.
See ya.